Hi, I'm Robin.
And I'm Chris. Together we're the Gen X couple.
Hey guys.
Take two.
It was the computer's fault. It wasn't anybody, it wasn't a human issue. It was our dumb computer because it's old. We need a new one.
Well, hello everyone.
We hope everyone's new year is off to an amazing start.
Ours has been pretty uneventful so far.
Yeah, that's how I like it. And today we are launching a new series. And if you already read the title of the episode, you know it's about interesting facts.
Yeah, we're going to do this series once a month going forward.
Yeah, once a month seems like it would work. And for today, we have 10 random facts for you guys. And going forward, we may do random facts or we may even go with a theme. It's all kind of up in the air right now, so stay tuned.
So next month, we might do some interesting facts about Valentine's Day.
Yeah, that's a good idea, actually. I should write that down. Thanks, Chris. But we're definitely making a series out of it, and we hope you find these as interesting as we did. And before we get started, I thought I should just mention that I got this information from all across the interwebs. And we all know that everything on the internet is true, right?
Says Abraham Lincoln.
Exactly.
So I'm going to start us off. Did you know that more than 80% of the ocean remains unexplored? Scientists have a better map of Mars' surface than they do of our own ocean. It's true. We still haven't found Loch Ness or the Kraken.
Release the Kraken. But yeah, so despite being over 100 million miles away, Mars is relatively accessible compared to the ocean's depths due to technological advances in space exploration and imaging, while underwater environments remain incredibly challenging to explore. The deep ocean is incredibly difficult to explore because of high pressure, darkness, and cold temperatures, all of which require highly specialized equipment. Space, though inhospitable, doesn't have the crushing pressures that's found in deep ocean environments. Modern spacecraft and imaging technology can gather data from Mars more easily than submersibles can navigate the ocean's depths. Mars has been mapped in very high detail thanks to orbiters and landers that have sent back comprehensive data. NASA's Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, for example, has a camera that captures images with a resolution of about 0.3 meters per pixel. In contrast, only about 20% of Earth's seafloor is mapped with similar detail. Sonar mapping, the primary method of deep sea exploration, is slower and less precise over large areas.
In space exploration, due to its pioneering nature and public intrigue, receives more funding and attention than ocean exploration.
That makes sense.
Missions to Mars are often prioritized in national and international space programs. While ocean exploration, despite its importance for understanding climate and biodiversity, often receives less funding. And light doesn't penetrate the deep ocean, making visible imaging challenging.
Visual imaging?
Yep.
Yeah, you said visible.
Researchers rely on sonar and remote operated vehicles with powerful lights. But this equipment can only cover small areas at a time. Mars, with no such visibility issues, can be imaged from afar by orbiters or space rovers. Understanding Mars holds potential for big discoveries, like evidence of a past life, the truth is out there.
It sure is.
Which fuels more scientific interest, while ocean research is crucial for understanding ecosystems and climate. It doesn't carry the same appeal of potential discoveries that another planet might.
Yeah, I get it. And to be honest, I'm kind of terrified about what's down deep in the ocean. And I think it may be best just to let sleeping dogs lie.
True story.
And here's the next fact for you. Did you know that our brains generate about 12 to 25 watts of electricity, which is actually enough to power a small LED light?
Probably 100 watts in my case.
Oh, for sure. Our brains are incredibly energy-intensive organs. They consume about 20% of our body's total energy, even though they only make up about 2% of our body weight. This high energy consumption comes from the brain's constant activity. Neurons are firing electrical signals, they're processing information, maintaining connections, and ensuring smooth communication across the entire nervous system.
The brain's electricity isn't produced in a steady stream like a battery. Instead, it comes from the synchronized firing of neurons, which release bursts of electrical impulses that, when added up, result in this overall energy output.
This electrical activity is crucial for all brain functions, from basic survival tasks like breathing to more complex activities like problem solving or creativity. The small electric currents generated by the neurons' movement of ions, things like sodium, potassium, and calcium, are also what make brain imaging techniques such as EEGs, which stands for electroencephalograms, possible.
So we're going to go back to outer space for this next one. In space, metals can bond without heat. This phenomenon, called cold welding, happens because atoms on clean, flat metal surfaces have no way to know they are separate. Cold welding, also known as contact welding, is a fascinating phenomenon that occurs in space or in a vacuum environment, where two clean, flat metal surfaces can bond together without heat or melting. This happens because in the absence of an oxidizing atmosphere like Earth's, the atoms on these metal surfaces are not coated with any protective layer such as oxides. On Earth, when metals are exposed to air, a thin layer of oxide or contaminants forms on the surface, which prevents metal atoms from bonding directly. But in the vacuum of space, if two ultra-clean metal surfaces come into contact, their atoms essentially see no barrier between each other. The atomic force then pulls the surfaces together, creating a solid bond as they were a single piece of metal. Cold welding is useful in certain manufacturing and research contexts where a vacuum environment can be controlled to create strong metal bonds without the need for heat. However, in spacecraft, this can also present a challenge, as unintentional cold welding between components can cause issues with moving parts or equipment that needs to be detached. Engineers use special coatings or lubricants to prevent this unintended bonding in space.
Who knew?
Yeah, sounds like magic to me.
It does, for sure. And not going to lie, that one was kind of boring. Sorry, you guys. It was interesting, but kind of boring. But this next one I thought was absolutely fascinating. Did you know that about 12% of people dream entirely in black and white? This percentage was actually much higher before the spread of color television. So before color TV became widespread in the 1950s and 60s, a large portion of people, and some studies suggest up to 75%, reported dreaming in black and white. One theory is that before color TV, people's mental images during dreams were influenced by the media they consumed, which was predominantly black and white. As color television and films became more common, people were exposed to color imagery, which may have subtly changed the way their minds processed visual information during sleep. Today, younger generations who have only always been exposed to color media almost universally dream in color, while older generations are more likely to experience black and white dreams. This suggests that dreaming in black and white might not be a biological default, but rather a culturally influenced phenomenon that can shift with media exposure.
I only dream of marshmallow.
Oh my God. So that means you dream in white?
Yes.
I dream in color. I'm one of those people, I dream a lot, pretty much every night. And I know that not everyone can remember their dreams, but I'm a very vivid dreamer. And I genuinely can't even imagine not having my dreams in color.
And moving on. Do you know the octopus have three hearts? Two pump blood to the gills, while the third pumps it to the rest of the body.
Yeah, octopuses are remarkable creatures with three hearts. And here's how their unique circulatory system works. First, they have two bronchial hearts. These two hearts are located near each gill and are responsible for pumping blood through the gills. The primary role is to send deoxygenated blood to the gills, where it becomes oxygenated. Each bronchial heart serves one gill, ensuring that blood is efficiently oxygenated. Secondly, they have a systemic heart, and this is the main heart that plumps. Oh my God, I can't talk now. This is the main heart that pumps oxygenated blood from the gills to the rest of the body. It supplies the octopus's organs and muscles with the oxygen needed to sustain high energy levels, especially when it's hunting, exploring, or escaping from predators. Interestingly, octopuses use copper-based hemocyanin instead of the iron-based hemoglobin that humans have, which gives their blood a blue color instead of red. Hemocyanin is particularly suited for low oxygen environments, which is beneficial for deep or low oxygen waters that many octopuses inhabit.
And if I had three hearts, does that mean I can love marshmallow more?
Listen, give it a rest, you two.
One more fun fact about octopuses is the systemic heart actually stops beating temporarily, which is the thought to be why octopuses prefer crawling to swimming. It's more energy efficient and puts less strain on their circulatory system.
Yeah. Did you say when they swim, it stops beating temporarily?
Yeah. That's why they crawl all the time.
Yeah, that makes so much sense now. Octopuses are super cool. And now I think I like them even more than I did before.
They are pretty cool creatures.
They are. And here's a fun fact that actually blew my mind. Did you know that Cleopatra lived closer in time to the first moon landing than to the construction of the Great Pyramid of Giza? This fact is a fascinating reminder of how vast the span of history truly is. Cleopatra VII, the last active ruler of the Ptolemaic Kingdom of Egypt, lived from 69 to 30 BCE. The Great Pyramid of Giza, however, was completed around 2560 BCE, nearly 2,500 years before Cleopatra's time. So, to put that in perspective, Cleopatra lived only about 2,000 years before the first moon landing in 1969. This means she was closer in time to modern achievements like space exploration than to the era of Egypt's Old Kingdom when the Great Pyramid was built. I think this contrast really highlights how ancient Egyptian civilizations really stretched across millennia with its historical phases like the Old Kingdom, Middle Kingdom, and New Kingdom, and spanned vast periods of time, each with its own advancements and rulers, of course.
I never would have guessed that. And since math is my thing, I'm going to take this next one and hopefully Robin doesn't fall asleep.
I'll try my best.
Zero wasn't always a given. The concept of zero as a number was invented in ancient India around the 5th century. The concept of zero as a number is fascinating because it wasn't universally recognized or used in early mathematics. Around the 5th century, mathematicians in ancient India introduced the idea of zero as both a placeholder and a number in its own right. This was a significant development because zero allowed for new levels of mathematical computation and notation. Before this breakthrough, many ancient cultures used systems that didn't require a zero. For example, the Roman numeral system doesn't include a zero.
I didn't know that.
It simply leaves a blank space if there's nothing in a particular place value.
Hmm.
The ancient Babylonians, who developed an early place value system, initially used a kind of placeholder but didn't treat zero as a number with its own value. In India, mathematicians like Brahmagupta, who is often credited...
I think it's pronounced Brahmagupta.
Well, he's pretty famous for creating and formalizing the rules of zero. He wrote rules for operations involving zeros, including addition and subtraction. This development allowed for a fully functional decimal place value system, which became essential for more advanced mathematics and spread to the Middle East, where scholars translated Indian mathematical texts by the 9th century. The concept had made its way to Europe thanks to scholars like Al-Khwarizmi and eventually revolutionized mathematics globally.
I think it's Al-Khwarizmi.
He did a lot of work for the zero.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm sure we both just butchered that. Sorry, sir.
The invention of zero wasn't just about a numeral. It marked a shift in thinking that allowed mathematics to evolve into the system we use today, supporting algebra, my favorite, calculus, and eventually computer science.
Yeah, I have nothing. I don't understand math. I've never understood math. I will never understand math. I don't care about math, and I'm going to change the subject immediately. Did you know that humans share about 60% of their DNA with bananas?
No, I did not know that.
While we're far more complex, this similarity is a reminder of our shared genetic code across life forms. This might sound surprising, but it actually highlights a crucial point about genetic coding and evolution. DNA is a fundamental building block of life. We know this. And many basic cellular processes and structures... I almost tripped over my words. You are rubbing off on me. Many basic cellular processes and structures are conserved across vastly different organisms, from plants to animals. So, in simpler terms, all living things need similar molecular tools to survive and function, like the ability to make proteins or store genetic information. So this means that even though humans and bananas look and function quite differently, we both use some of the same genes to perform basic biological tasks, things like regulating cell growth and responding to cellular signals. That 60% similarity doesn't mean we're 60% banana, though.
You know, Marshmallow is 60% wolf and 40% my heart.
She is 0% wolf. I'm sorry. Have you met her? She is the most spoiled diva of any dog that has ever lived on the face of the planet. She is 0% wolf.
She's a predator.
I stand by what I said. So, yeah, we're not 60% banana. Instead, what that stat points to is that shared genes between humans and bananas do fundamental housekeeping jobs at the cellular level. I just pulled a Chris. Cellular. Oh my goodness. The closer two species are evolutionarily, the more DNA they share. So for instance, humans share about 98.8% of DNA with chimpanzees. With bananas, it's really just a reminder of our common origins in the evolutionary tree of life and how at a molecular level, life on Earth is all interconnected.
That's bananas.
I knew that was coming.
I couldn't let that slide. You know that.
Yeah, I know.
So here's another interesting one. There are over 7,000 languages spoken in the world today, but approximately one language dies every 2 weeks.
Yeah, so the world's linguistic diversity is astounding. And there are over 7,000 languages spoken across continents, but like Chris said, many of them are rapidly disappearing. And again, like Chris said, one language dies about every 2 weeks, which equates to 26 languages vanishing every year. And that rate of loss is actually pretty alarming, considering that with each language, we lose unique cultural knowledge, traditions, and ways of understanding the world. The reasons for the language extinction are pretty complex, but they're often tied to globalization, urbanization, and cultural assimilation. Smaller communities whose languages aren't as widely spoken outside their regions are especially vulnerable. As people migrate to cities, adopt dominant languages for economic or social advancement, and marry outside of their linguistic groups, they may shift away from their native languages.
And efforts to preserve endangered languages include documentation, education, and encouraging younger generations to continue using these languages. Organizations in linguistics are working with communities to record these languages and create learning resources. In some cases, technology has become an ally, with apps, online courses, and social media helping to connect speakers and create virtual language communities. Like, I was part of an Elfish community.
Oh, you shouldn't have told everybody that. That's kind of embarrassing for you. Anyway, we're finally at the last interesting fact of the day here, and that is that people subconsciously synchronize their body language and breathing when they are in sync during a conversation or an activity. And this phenomenon is known as synchrony or mirroring, and it occurs as a way to build rapport. I said rapport, but I meant rapport, because I'm not dumb and I know how to pronounce that, and foster a sense of connection between individuals. And people tend to match each other's breathing rhythms. So, for example, if one person, what is my problem today? I cannot talk. So, if one person is breathing deeply and slowly, the other person might subconsciously adjust their breath to match. This can help create a sense of calm and mutual understanding. In more intense conversations or emotional moments, breathing rates might actually speed up or completely slow down altogether, reflecting shared emotional states. Body language is also affected by synchrony. People may start adopting similar postures or gestures without even realizing it. Say if one person leans forward, the other person might do the same. Similarly, if one person crosses their arms, the other might mirror that action. This mimicking is also a subconscious sign of empathy and emotional connection. And people who are in sync will also mirror each other's facial expressions. If one person smiles or raises their eyebrows in surprise, say, the other person might subconsciously do the same. This mirroring helps to reinforce the emotional bond between the two individuals. And in conversations, people often synchronize their speaking pace, volume, and tone. So if one person speaks quickly, like I think I'm speaking very quickly right now, the other person might match that speed. And if one person speaks slowly, the other person will follow suit. The pacing adjustment facilitates smoother communication and helps people feel more understood. And basically what I'm getting at is synchronization is a nonverbal way of showing people that you're attuned to each other's emotions and cues, and that can enhance trust, rapport, and make interactions feel more natural and connected.
Yeah, I'm going to have to try and pay attention to that because I had no idea I was doing that.
Honestly, me neither.
And that does it for today. You know what to do. Check us out on Instagram. Leave us a review on the app where you listen to the podcast. And email us with any questions or if you have a story to share.
Yeah, that just about covered it, Chris. Thank you. If you guys have stories, we may read them on the pod at some point. So feel free to email them to us at thegenxcouplepodcast@gmail.com. Next week, we've got a very exciting interview coming up. So make sure you tune in for that. And until next time.
See you later, alligator.
In a wild crocodile.